So someone asked me this week what I thought of the news reports that have come out of Jerusalem that you may have heard, may have read about, this discovery of what some suggest is unequivocal evidence of a family grave of one Jesus, son of Joseph, his wife Mary, and his son Judah. The grave dates back to the time of Jesus and has physical remains of his body, supposedly, which would call then into question the bodily resurrection. There was a documentary done about this in 2007 called The Lost Tomb of Jesus, about this grave that was found in the 1980s, and the all this controversy surfaced around it. And then the fella that was laying all this out was kind of discredited. But now there's supposedly more evidence that justifies the original claim. So the verdict is still out at this point as to whether Jesus' actual grave and body are there. And many archaeologists are saying they await its publication in a peer-reviewed journal before making any judgments about it. So it's there. You can read it in the Huffington Post, I think, is where it was, or something like that. Jesus' grave and bones is what they're saying. So it's certainly scintillating to hear this, and rather scandalous, I would say. The fact that it comes out right around Easter, when the vast number of people across the globe are celebrating the bodily resurrection of Jesus, makes me groan a little bit in skepticism. Really? But I have to say, from a personal perspective, the thought of such a finding doesn't really rattle my faith much. Not because I'm so certain that it is not true, but because my faith, my engagement with God, and my being a follower of Christ is not really all that dependent upon certainty of that kind. Questions and doubts are part and parcel of the faith journey. To be honest, I don't know exactly who Jesus Christ is in the first place, and what exactly the resurrection is truly about. So that a finding of Jesus of Nazareth's bones would not exactly knock me off my faith game, a game I really don't know how to play in the first place. I know it's kind of quite a confession to come from your pastor. I like the quote that's in the bulletin, that I put in the bulletin, that says, when author Madeline L'Engle was asked, "Do you believe in God without any doubts?" she replied, "I believe in God with all my doubts." Right? Similarly to the question, "Do you believe in the resurrection of Jesus?" will without any doubts, I would say, "I believe in the resurrection with all of my doubts." And I would argue that being skeptical that I fully get Jesus and the whole resurrection thing in the first place puts me in pretty good company. Because even the disciples who knew Jesus and experienced his bodily return prior to the ascension were not really clear as to what exactly was going on. The Apostle Paul, who was the first to write about it, describes it in a number of different ways to try and get at what this profound mystical relationship with an executed Jewish peasant and the transformation of his life was all about. The Gospels are also grappling with the immense reality in different ways, and their accounts vary. Yes. Exactly. Sometimes I feel like that. Their accounts vary. As you heard at Easter, the Gospel of Mark says that the women found the tomb empty with one young man in white sitting there. and that they were so terrified that they said nothing to anyone. While the Gospel of John says that Mary found no body in the tomb, but two angels there and a gardener who turned out to be Jesus himself, and that she ran and brought the other disciples to see. While the Gospel of Luke, on the other hand, says that there were two men dressed in dazzling white there in the tomb at the foot and the head of where Jesus had laid. And these two men spoke to the women who were there, Mary Magdalene and others, saying, "Why do you seek the living among the dead?" All right? So what I'm saying is that you don't really have to go 2,000 years later to an archaeological dig that claims to have found Jesus' bones to have reasons for questions and doubts about who in the world this Jesus is and what actually happened. Only read the Gospels and the letters of Paul closely, and you should have enough questions and confusions to rattle any faith that is dependent upon consistent, verifiable facts and certainties. Lawrence Freeman, the director of the World Community of Christian Meditation, has written a book called Jesus, the Teacher Within. And he claims that the single most important statement in all the New Testament on Jesus' lips was not an explanation, was not an aphorism, was not a command or an answer to a question. The single most important thing on Jesus' lips was a question he asked the disciples. And the question was, "Who do you say that I am?" Who do you say that I am? Peter, in typical Peter fashion, races to an answer, and this time basically gets it right. Woo, good job, Peter. Basically gets it right, and saying, "You are the Christ." But then that begs the question, who in the world is the Christ, and what is the Christ about, and what does that mean? Because it becomes clear that Peter and the other disciples really did not know what that meant during Jesus' life. And at his death, they knew even less. And when they had this mind-blowing, heartbreaking, life-transforming experience of Jesus' return somehow, in glorified form, they scrambled to try and explain what they were experiencing. They were struggling to know beyond all mental knowing what they knew in their heart of hearts of what was happening. Namely, God somehow, whatever we mean by that, revealing God's self in them and around them in ways heretofore unknown. And the revelation was about something about healing of physical selves and community relations, and it was about love and the meaning of it all, and it was about this life, and it was about beyond this life, it was about this dimension, and so much bigger and deeper and greater than this dimension, and above all, it was just true and life-transforming. However, the mind or the language failed or succeeded in grasping it and explaining it. So when I consider faith and what it means to believe in God and trust in God and be in relationship to God, in relationship to Jesus, I personally have a lot of doubts. Not doubts that one day I might find out it's all a big lie. I doubt it. But I rather a lot of niggling, troubling, disturbing doubts that I am actually grasping even a fraction of what the scriptures and our tradition are pointing to when they speak of God and Jesus, the revelation and the resurrection in the days to come. And sometimes I am disturbed by that fact. That I am in this role as your minister, as a minister of the Christian church, and I have such doubts about my capacity to get it. But I have to take deep breaths in those moments, and remind myself that I am in good company again. The disciples themselves, who had a direct, bodily, tactile experience of Jesus, did not recognize him at first, much less understand. They didn't even recognize him. In fact, Thomas refused to accept or believe anything until he had physical verifiable evidence. And isn't it interesting that Jesus is recognized in a couple of the resurrection appearances, not by his face or his familiar physique or his voice or what he says, but how? By his wounds. He says, look, and then they're like, recognized by his wounds in his glorified state. The disciples were terrified and silent until he showed them his wounds, and then they recognized him. Thomas refused to believe until he put his finger in Jesus' wounds, and then he said, my Lord and my God. God is revealed somehow, not despite the agony and the suffering of Jesus and his passion, but in it and through it. But then more confusion and more doubts follow even after that. Wouldn't it be great if it was just like, okay, there was Jesus, now we know, end of story. It's all been answered. I mean, great on certain level, but no, you know, this is the journey of life that is so tragic and beautiful. So more confusion and doubts follow. They say, okay, great, now what? And a clear answer is not immediately to follow. In fact, no answer comes at all. Something else comes 50 days later at Pentecost, but it's not exactly an answer. And we are not quite there yet in our church season, but we will get there on May 24th to consider that moment. About 43 days hence. In the meantime, we are left with the question, who do you say that I am? You've heard what I taught. You saw me suffer on Holy Week. You celebrated my resurrection at Easter. And so now, who do you say that I am? Who am I in your life? The question is asked of you and 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 me. Who do you say that I am? All of us are asked, and this is significantly what it means to be a Christian, to seek and to know God, is to ask that question and struggle with that question and wrestle with the angel in the dark around that question. In Buddhism, it is said that if you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. Have you heard that, Cone? If you meet Buddha on the road, kill him. To emphasize how mistaken we inevitably are with all our images and conceptions of Buddha or of God. So if you meet him, kill him. It's not him in your conception of that. If you think you've met him, you're probably wrong. I would offer a Christian version of the cone and say, if you meet someone who can absolutely answer Jesus' question, who do you say that I am? Kill him. I'm speaking metaphorically, of course. For two reasons, kill them. One, because their answer to that question is most likely not going to be your answer to that question. And you need to answer it for yourself. And secondly, any pat answer is probably going to be more false than true, because God cannot be contained in our answers. God can only be sought and lived in our questions. Do you realize that the New Testament itself, get this, the New Testament itself has over 140 different names or answers for that question. 140 varying names for who in the world this Jesus was and is. This Jesus Christ. So I imagine we are pretty safe to say there are a lot of answers, and maybe an infinite number of answers to the question, who do you say that I am? It's the journey of answering the question rather than the answer itself. So I'd like to end my sermon, and this is the reason we have our screen up here, with a meditation on some of those 140 names that will scroll up the screen. I hope they're big enough for you to see in just a moment. 140 names for Jesus. So we've got to listen to and hear the question, who do you say that I am, directed to each of us individually and as a community of faith, and we've got to seek to answer the question as a central part of our journey. Great. I mean, there are people that come, I've talked to many people who say, I'm not sure who Jesus is. I don't know what it means. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus was resurrected. Yes, exactly. Grapple with that. That is the question. That is the question of faith. Who is Jesus to you? Who do you say I am? But we probably won't come all that close to answering it, you know, without some discipline around the effort to answer it, without some practice of silence, of prayer, of attentiveness and devotion. So the question is, how much do we want to answer the question? Answers won't come by Googling it. Answers won't come by asking me or Susan. And I need to be careful now that I've told you to kill such answers. Answers won't come if we stay up here, trying to figure it all out with our minds, because we've got to submerge beneath the surface and into silence, and we've got to read the scriptures prayerfully and allow them to work on us, and we've got to pray with heavy doses of listening and be in this relationship. Jesus asks you today, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am?